Station number 8739, reel number 1.
Admiral Madden, reel 1. How did you first become involved with the preparations for D-Day?
Well, I was at HMS Dryad, which was the navigation school, taking a course of R&R and R&VR officers to try and make them navigators of warships for the rest of the war. And I was relieved from there, and I was told to join the invasion forces known at that time as Force J, and I was to be the navigating officer and staff officer operations to Captain GJ3.
What was GJ3?
GJ3 was Assault Group Force J number 3. And with those orders, I joined an establishment called HMS Mastodon, which was, in fact, the Rothschild home at Exbury House on the Beaulieu River. I joined on Monday the 16th of August, 1943, and roughly at the same time as I joined my captain, Captain A.F. Pugsley, and his secretary, Lieutenant Elliot, R&VR, joined together. Now, HMS Mastodon was a sort of holding camp for the invasion forces. When anybody was going to join any part of Force J, and they didn't know exactly where to go, they went to Mastodon. We joined there and were there for a few days. And after about the second day, we moved out to our main headquarters, which was Leap House at the mouth of the Beaulieu River. When we arrived at our headquarters, there was absolutely nothing there except for a delightful house. But there was nothing in it. There was no light, there was no hot water, there was no staff, there was nothing. But this, nevertheless, did not prevent us going on our first exercise on Friday the 20th of August, which was 4 days after we had actually started to join. I should explain here that at this time there was one main assault force forming, which was Force J, and it was based at HMS Vectis, which was in fact the Royal Yacht Squadron at Cowes. It then had a commodore in command with a staff, and the force consisted, Force J, consisted of Assault Group J1 and J2, with J3 as the reserve group. Our assault group at that time, at least our group, was J3, which was then the reserve force. But after a short while, this was altered, and we became an assault group as opposed to a reserve group, and we became GJ1. And henceforth, I will concentrate on talking on GJ1 as an assault group rather than as a reserve group. Now, there were two groups. There were GJ1 and GJ2. And we were almost exactly similar, and we had the same tasks, which were to each land a brigade plus certain attached specialized forces on adjacent beaches on the enemy coast. Thus, GJ1 and GJ2 were the assault groups, and the reserve group was GJ3, and between them, the three groups formed a division, and in our case was the 3rd Canadian Division. As well as that, there was a Canadian Armoured Division in addition. From the first days of our being, we began to collect our various craft as they were built, as they were manned, and as they were commissioned, and then brought round to the south of England, which in our case was the Solent, Spithead, and our headquarters, of course, was on the Beaulieu River. And so the places they really collected all these craft of various types, various shapes, and had various tasks. We're at Southampton, Calshot, the Hamble River, the Beaulieu River, the Lymington, Cowes, Portsmouth, Chichester, and so on. These craft came from far and wide. Most of them were made, constructed, built, and manned in the UK, but some were built, the bigger ones at any rate, in America, and they were LCILs, landing craft infantry, large, LSTs, landing ship tanks, and some LSIs, landing ship infantry. These, in fact, were built, as I've said, in the States, and they were sailed over from the States in various stages by various people. And, in fact, before I leave this particular part of the story, I, in fact, brought one of the flights of LCILs back from the States, having been built there, to England. As a matter of interest, there were an enormous amount of LCILs, some hundreds, which were brought over, and they came over in flights. The flight I'm talking about was LCIL flight number 8. These craft were extraordinary looking ships. They were about 200 feet long, and they could hold, when full, of soldiers some 200 bodies. But to do the ocean passage, we had about 20 sailors altogether and 3 officers, and I was one of the ocean captains of one of them and second in command of the flight. And these ships were built in a matter of weeks, even less. They had as propulsion 8 lorry engines in 2 banks of 4. Absolutely basic. They had an Oerlikon in the bow and 4 depth charges in the stern, and that was it. And we left Norfolk, Virginia, with 22 of these craft, and my senior officer was lieutenant commander, a few years older than me, and I was the navigator, and it was decided that I should lead the whole group in 4 lines. 4 lines of 5 and 4 lines of 4. And it was remembered it was quite a long way to go from Norfolk, Virginia, to, in fact, Gibraltar. We were going to stop at Bermuda, and did so. But we were completely unarmed, and we were always a little bit frightened that if we were spotted by an aircraft, it was pretty easy for one submarine to surface near us and to take us off one by one. Anyhow, this didn't happen. And it's not part of the story to say what occurred on this trip, but we started with 22 and we finished in Gibraltar with 23. And I leave you with the conundrum how this happened. One of my first jobs when I joined GJ3, and everybody was very new about how things happened, was to do the trials of one of our home-converted LSTs, landing ship tanks. Most of the LSTs used on the invasion were, in fact, made in America. But the British, did build one or two, and we converted a number of others. And this particular one, I had to do trials to run on a beach, was an ex-Maracaibo lake tanker. Maracaibo is a lake in Venezuela, and a lot of the oil tankers, indeed a lot of the oil in that part of the world, was run by the British. And this craft was thought to be suitable to turn into a landing ship tank. And my job, with the captain, who had never done it before either, was to put this on a beach to see how to do it, and what occurred. It's probably worth explaining beaching a ship or craft. The same theories apply from the biggest to the smallest. And the first thing is that it is against all principles for a seaman to put a ship onto any type of land, be it a beach or anything else. And the problems are many. The most difficult of all, as you approach a beach to put a ship on it, is to tell the distance off. One moment you're a long way off, you think, and the next moment you're right there. The next problem is how hard you should put the ship onto the beach. Because if you put the ship in too hard, you probably won't get it off again. And if you put it on too lightly, it might float off. And also, it will provide a very wet landing onto the beach for the vehicles and the men you have in your ship. It is usually the best to put a ship on a beach on a flood tide, which is going upwards, or slack, but if possible, never on an ebb. Because if you put one on an ebb tide, with the tide going out, it is very difficult to get it off, even though, as you get your vehicles off your ship, you do lighten the load, and you have a chance of floating. The next problem is when you put a ship on a beach, the waves, once you arrived, or the set of the tide, which you always get on a beach, or the wind, tends to swivel your stern. So instead of remaining at right angles to the beach, which you would like to, you tend to get broadside on. And you get across the beach, which of course makes it very difficult to get off, and very difficult for the craft to leave the ship, because they have the waves coming in sideways. So to avoid that, you have a stern anchor, which the theory is, as you come in, you let go your anchor, and you keep the wire taut, so that you keep at right angles to the beach. But the difficulty, as I said right at the beginning, is to tell your distance off. You can sometimes get bearings at right angles to your ship as you come in, but often you can't. Because if you let go your anchor too far out, you run out of wire before you arrive. And if it's too short, your anchor goes down, and when you pull the wire in to keep you straight, the anchor doesn't get a grip and comes into the ship and has no effect in keeping you straight. Then the next difficulty is using your engines. Because it's so shallow that if you use your engines a lot, and one tends to keep you straight, sand gets in the water coolant, and the next thing you know, your engines heat up and you have to stop them. On top of all this, you have the problem of the beach gradient. Is it flat or is it semi-vertical? So you have a great many problems which you have to consider. And this applies to all types of ship, be they large or small. In this case, we managed, not very well, but it was certainly possible, and this particular ship and its class were passed for future use. But in fact, the British made a number of LSTs. They weren't as good, I don't think, as the American ones, because they were too Rolls-Royce type, and they were too expensive, really, to be expendable. The whole thing about an LST, and the whole thing about all landing craft, is that they have to be cheap, easily built, quickly built, and if they did get into trouble, you simply left them. Now, this is perhaps the moment to try and explain the various craft used in an open beach assault, from big to small. Now, I have mentioned LSTs. They were not used in the assault. They came later in the reserve and the follow-up. And they were quite big ships, I'm talking about 2,000 to 3,000 tons and 300 feet long. But ships that were used, and they were big ones, for the assault were LSIs, Landing Ship Infantry. They carried a large amount of infantry, and each ship had a number of LCAs, Landing Craft Assault. All big ships have lifeboats, but in this case, the lifeboats were removed, and instead of the lifeboats, there were special davits made, and these craft, Landing Craft Assault, were hoisted in their stead. And depending on the size of the ship, they had 6 LCAs, 8 LCAs, and some of the bigger ones had even as many as 16. In our group, nearly all our ships were ex-cross-channel steamers, such as, and they were very well known in those days, the Maid of Kent, the Queen Emma, the Invicta, and we had some bigger ones, and one of them was the Langibby Castle, who in fact had, I think, 16 LCAs. Altogether, we had 10 of these ships. And then we had LCILs, which I have already mentioned. And then we had LCISs, Landing Craft Infantry, small. And we had LCVPs, Landing Craft Vehicles, personnel. All these craft did various jobs. And one of the main type of craft which we had were LCTs, Landing Craft Tanks. And we had three different kinds, though there were many others. We had at least LCT-3s. They were the biggest. They were 220 feet long. They had two engines. They were extremely difficult to handle. Both the engines went the same way, which from the maneuvering point of view makes life very difficult, because most ships have outward turning propellers, and these ones had the same way turning propellers to the right. In fact, the LCT-3s, on the whole, were rarely considered rather difficult to load and put on a beach. Though this didn't apply all the way around, and they were converted to rather specialized roles, and a lot of them were turned into what is known as LCTRs, rocket craft. Some were turned into LCGs, which was guns, and they had quite big guns in them. I think some of them were even 4-inch guns, and some of the LCTs were turned into carrying specialized vehicles like the DD tanks, which were the swimming tanks. As well as that, we had another type of LCT, LCT-4. They weren't quite as long as the others. They were 180 feet long. Again, they had two engines, which turned the same way. And they were used, in our case, with tanks and vehicles. They could carry some 6 to 8 tanks and vehicles between them. And finally, we had another type called the LCT-5. They were shorter and wider and were much more maneuverable, were thoroughly easy to handle compared to the others, because they had 3 screws. And so you had two outer ones, which always you could move the same way, like a head or stern, and you could do the steering with the middle one. Some of these craft, as I have said, were converted to different roles, like the rocket LCTR, and then there was the LCT Avery, and these are very important craft, or the role they did was was AVRI stands for Assault Vehicle Royal Engineers. And these were tanks which were converted so that on the assault, when it was known the beaches were mined and had various difficulties put in the way by the enemy, these craft, which had flails and various other type of machinery to make the beach safe for the infantry that followed, were taken in these LCT and they were part of the assault. And we will come to more of what they did later in my talk. As well as all these craft, we had others, and I enumerate them now. LCGLs, they were landing craft guns, bracket large, and they were landing craft small. And they had different kinds of weapons on board, and the whole idea was that they could go right into the beach with the assault, and they had very little draft and could really put some punch into any enemy resistance on the beach. As well as that, there were LCFs, landing craft flak, and they were anti-aircraft. And there was another craft called an LCAH, and this was a landing craft which had hedgehog. And they were just 60-pound spigot bombs, 24 of them, in this fairly small craft, and the idea was that they would fire off quite close to the beach and break up any enemy things they had, no, stop, any type of obstacle which the enemy had put on the beach. And there were a number of them. Talking about obstacles, there was one called Element C, which is a steel obstacle in gates about 8 feet in height and 10 foot in width. There was one called a hedgehog, made of lengths of 6-inch angle iron, joined in the center and forming a tripod obstacle, approximately 6 foot high. There was another one called a tetrahedra, a pyramid obstacle made of steel bars, about 3 feet high. And as well as that, there were a number of stakes of wood, 8 to 10 feet high, long, and about 10 inches in diameter, driven into the beach to a depth of 3 to 4 feet. Most of these were mined with telemines, and as well as that, there were mines and shells put into the beach itself. These were some of the craft whose job it was to try and make it easier and safer for the infantry. As well as all these rather extraordinary type of craft, we had more conventional boats and ships attached to us for specific exercises and, of course, the operation itself, such as MLs, MGBs, and destroyers, and, of course, also minesweepers. I think this is the moment to spare a thought for those who years before had thought of the necessity to have these craft at all. They were obviously part of the original combined operation. We, of course, who had to handle these craft, criticized them for what they were meant to do and the way they operated. But there was no question about it. A great deal of thought and thanks has to be made to those who, when this kind of operation was purely a spark in the eye, that these people were designing and building, earmarking material, the engines, the guns, and the personnel, most of which, nearly all in fact, were RNVRs or RNRs or simply ordinary civilians who had to do the job. And I think we all thought later what a great credit had to be given to these people. Now, the jobs we had to do were legion. To go through a checklist, we had 10 months to go in the event, and we had to work during this period a training teaching, exercising, planning, having meetings, visiting, lecturing, explaining, writing orders, having more meetings, and finally, keeping our fingers crossed. As well as all this, of course, we had to get to know the commanding officers, the squadron officers, and as many of the ship's companies of these craft as we possibly could. We had to check the hards where the craft had to go to load up, which craft should go where and could go where, what the gradients were of these hards. When I say a hard, this is... A hard is a ramp made of concrete, and it has to be graded at the right angle, so a vehicle, a man, a lorry, or indeed anything that has to be put from the shore to the ship has to go over this hard, and we had to check them all, wherever they were, all over the surface of Spithead, and of course there were many of them. And not only did we have to see to the approaches from the sea, but we had to also make certain they were suitable for the troops and the vehicles that were going to go into the ships, that they were also moderately easy to get at from the shore. This had all been planned months before, and again, great credit must go to the people who did that job. One of my first jobs was to do what is known as the beach gradient of Brackelsham Bay. Brackelsham Bay is just east of Chichester Harbour, between that and Selsey Bill. And the idea was that this bay would be used by our forces for practicing for the months ahead. I had never done one, a beach gradient, before, and really the task was to see how the beach shelved from low water up to high water. I did this, not particularly well, and it was done professionally after me. All I remember about it was that I got extremely wet. Nevertheless, my efforts did begin in that we had an exercise about 5 days after I had done it. Now, we joined in mid-August, and in early September we had our first exercise,